Our topic, we came up with this title, Geopolitics and Political Geology, the Persian Gulf Crisis. I was just listening on the radio tonight and vaguely with my shortwave radio at the top of the hill with all this aluminum foil on this extremely long antenna just to get National Public Radio a little bit from Spokane. And it sounds like the United States troop buildup really continues in Saudi Arabia, and that by the end of the week we'll have 200,000 troops there. So it's a very timely issue, and one I'm sure that most of you who have come in recently from the outside world know more about than we do at Holden. So I'll begin right there by saying that you're all experts tonight, and that's what we expect at a Holden Forum. We've got a few panelists just to kind of start the discussion, but forums are really a chance to hear from all of you. And as we bat ideas around and hear each other's viewpoints, we try to do that in a climate of care for one another. But certainly our goal tonight isn't to arrive at agreement or consensus on anything, but to just spend an hour together discussing an issue from a variety of perspectives. We'll end right at 25 to 9 after an hour, probably without much resolution, but hopefully having had a good conversation together. And I'll just moderate, look for hands and stuff, and field questions. And you can, actually, more than questions, I'd really invite you to share your views after we hear from these people up here. Starting us off will be two geologists, Mark Johnson and Rick Dunning, sharing some sort of geological perspectives on this, as well as historical perspectives. And then we'll hear from Al Pitcher and Dick Taylor kind of a little bit on what can we do or what should our response be. Al a little more from an environmental angle, and Dick on the issue of nonviolence. And then we'll open it up to all of you, and we really do want to hear from you. So let's begin with our geologists here.
Okay, I think I'll start. What I'll try and do in just a few minutes is provide a few notes of perspective, a little bit of historical perspective, and hopefully fit the present situation into a longer-term context as a result of that. I want you to begin by thinking back to the mid-70s. Remember the energy crisis? Remember long gas lines? Remember when gas prices went up so quickly, when much of what we heard about in the media had to do with oil shortages and running out of oil, and what were we going to do? Now, those problems in the 70s were precipitated mainly by two events. One in 1974 was the oil embargo by the OPEC nations, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. And then a second shortage or crisis was precipitated in 1979 by the Iranian Revolution and the year of unrest and tension that followed that. As we look back on those years now, retrospectively, we see that they weren't really true shortages in the sense of running out of a resource, but they were supply disruptions, production curtailments for one reason or another. Think about what the effects of those supply reductions were, about those constraints on our energy supplies in the 70s. It made the United States very much concerned about their reliance on foreign oil, imported oil. And it made us begin to look for other sources of energy, both in terms of other sources of petroleum, and particularly domestic production was expanded as a result of those events, at least initially. And I think a lot of the impetus to open up the Alaskan oil fields and to increase production in those Alaskan oil fields came as a result of these events in the 70s. Also, it made us much more aware of conservation. And things like the 55 mile an hour speed limit, restrictions on gas mileage on automobiles that were imposed by Congress, or at least hopefully imposed. And the higher prices in oil led to research and development of alternative energy sources, looking at different sources of petroleum other than traditional oil fields, and also non-traditional sources of energy such as solar. So in a sense, the higher prices helped pay for some alternative energy research. Now ultimately, we know that the OPEC relationship kind of broke down, that those countries, in terms of their relationship with each other and their ability to agree on and meet quotas, disintegrated into the early 80s. And as a result of that, many of the OPEC countries increased their production, increasing the supply of oil, and as the supply went up, price dropped. And so the price of oil per barrel dropped significantly from the late 70s and through the mid to late 1980s. Another thing that happened as a result of that was at least an initial decline in U.S. consumption, and that was one thing that helped to break the stranglehold of OPEC. We learned that conservation and consumer choice could be an effective force in terms of dealing with the energy supply situation. And by cutting back our consumption of energy, we actually did contribute to the breaking down the stranglehold that the OPEC nations had on prices, at least in the short term. Now, moving to the very recent events, just outlining a few of the things that have happened. OPEC in its recent meeting voted to raise the price of oil. Iraq was the main country pushing for this price rise, and these are the meetings in Geneva just weeks ago, just within the last couple of weeks. And Iraq was pushing for $25 a barrel, finally by threatening to use any means at their disposal to get that price. Most of the other countries agreed on $21 a barrel, which was a significant increase over what the prices have been. Within the wake of that OPEC meeting, almost immediately after the meeting, is when Iraq began to launch their current military action. Remember that Iraq has just been through a long war with Iran. They have very, very, very heavy debts as a result of that war, in the order of $60 to $80 billion. Their oil revenues have been down. They are feeling that pinch in terms of domestic economic struggles. And I think, at least in part, that economic difficulty is part of the incentive for this action that Iraq is taking. The immediate source of wealth at hand was the country of Kuwait. Virtually no defenses and lots of wealth within a small area right at their border. And that was where they aimed first. As a result of that action, Iraq now controls a significant amount of the world's oil reserves. About one-fifth of the oil reserves of the world are now, at least for the moment, under Iraqi control. And they're pretty sharp in the way that they went about this. This was a calculated maneuver. Because the other thing that this accomplishes for Iraq is by increasing tension in the Persian Gulf area, by disrupting the oil supply and the oil flow out of the Persian Gulf, prices go up, and they have gone up almost immediately as a result of that. So they are, in a sense, not only gaining control over the Kuwaiti resources, but they are also getting their desired increase in oil prices, which will probably ultimately go well beyond their $25 mark. We'll push probably over $30. And the other thing that it accomplishes for Iraq is it intimidates the other Persian Gulf states, the other oil-producing states, and in a sense intimidates them in such a way that they're not likely to go against Iraqi's actions. The scary thing for the United States, I think, is that the U.S. economy is pretty shaky right now without the oil situation. And higher oil prices will send shockwaves through the economy. Some people are talking recession as a result of these higher prices. But I think we need to put it in a broader context and realize that the global economy will be very much affected by these higher prices. And some of the countries that will be hurt the worst will be developing countries that have invested heavily in energy-consuming industries in recent time. Ultimately, the capacity of other oil-producing countries would be able to make up the loss of oil from Iraq and Kuwait. But we're looking at a period of 6 to 10 months for that additional production to come online. And so the short-term effects economically for the U.S. and the world are very serious. And those are some of the questions I think we need to deal with. I've kind of rambled a little more than I need to, but these are some of the things that I think help us to think about what context this whole thing is happening in.
Thanks. Mark?
I was thinking as you were reporting all these events in the past, how that has affected my life as a geologist when the oil embargo hit and prices rose. Oil companies hired geologists by the dozens, and at the University of Wisconsin, where I was at that time, we had all these oil companies coming to interview, and all my friends got jobs. And then in the early 80s, they were all let off as the OPEC fell apart and the price of oil went down and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, geologists are always kind of on the far right of things, conservatives. I think the only point I really want to make is that one thing that we have to remember in all our discussions about oil is that there's a finite amount of oil in the ground. It's likely to run out during the lifetimes of our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. There's not going to be enough time for oil to form in the ground that we can use. I think that's something that has to inform all our decisions. Are we going to let our addiction to a limited resource that has fueled this late 20th century world economy, are we going to continue to be tied to that in such a way that it leads to situations like we're in now in Iraq? And Al's going to talk about the environmental consequences of oil, another problem with our dependence on oil. I could talk a little bit about the geology of oil. It's not that important in a sense, except to say that like all resources on the planet, it occurs in cycles. There is oil being formed right now, brand new oil. There's coal being formed right now. These things always happen as the Earth goes through its changes. But it's a very slow process, and we're using, by comparison, the oil up at lightning speed. I think people, geologists, are pretty sure that they know where almost all the oil is in the ground. That when you speculate in the future how much oil is there available, I think, it's not certain. I think we're smart enough that we know where most of it is. Certainly we found all the easy oil. The oil that's a few thousand feet below the surface or less in Kansas and Texas and Oklahoma, we found that. I mean, the oil, I don't know what the figures are, but a very large percentage of the oil is in the in Saudi Arabia and these Arab countries, and they're just sitting in these puddles, huge pools, just below the surface, and it was very easy oil to find. Where are people going now to look for oil? The oil companies are pushing to go to the extremes on this planet to find oil. We've been in northern Alaska. It's a very difficult place to get oil, very expensive, lots of environmental problems. I worked for Mobil for one summer. Their exploration budget for the next year was $3 billion. $1 billion was for one oil platform in the North Sea. Many more offshore oil platforms in the Gulf of Mexico, in the North Sea, and elsewhere. It's very hard and very dangerous to get oil out of these places, but in our lust for oil, we were forced to go to literally the ends of the earth, the places where it's most hard to get. Like I said, it's dangerous, it's very costly, there's environmental consequences. How much are we willing to trade off? Now, one example, with changes in the Mideast situation, what's going to happen is that oil prices will go up, and this will probably make oil companies fairly happy in the United States because that will give them money to do more exploration here. And there'll be a great push to develop, say, offshore leases off of California. There'll be more pressure to develop places in Alaska where supposedly there is some oil. But interestingly, perhaps you've heard about this place in Alaska called the ANWR, stands for ANWR, Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. A very fragile ecosystem along a caribou migration route on the north side of the Brooks Range. But there's a kind of a nice oil field up there, little anticlines and synclines that are trapping some crude oil, and there's been some exploratory drilling up there, and of course there's lots of people that say we've got to have that oil, we've got to have more domestic oil to keep us from being dependent on these foreign sources. Plus people in Alaska, some might like it because it provides jobs, and the oil companies like it. One analysis, and you can use, anybody on any side of the issue here can quote statistics and say what they want, but a fairly conservative analysis of the amount of oil that's available in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge will increase our reserves to last the United States oil supplies 6 more months. So on the one hand, you have these issues: do we save the environment, or do we make ourselves less reliant on foreign oil? Well, when you look at it in that sense, imagine what you were doing 6 months ago, and as your life changed in such a way that it was worth ruining an environment on the north slope of Alaska. What are we willing to trade off? I really like the idea that this is kind of an addiction that we have with oil. It would be like as if you found out that smoking rolled Rembrandts gave you a high that you really liked, you know, and so people started stealing Rembrandts and smoking these, you know, and then you would run out and you wouldn't have any Rembrandts. One last thing about when is the oil going to run out. One person that writes about energy futures that I really respect a lot is a guy named Amory Lovins. He's a physicist. And he did some playing around with numbers and decided that looking at all the known world oil reserves and planning that a certain percent of that would be increased because, well, we'd find a little bit more oil here and there, that oil would run out. And I don't know the precise year, but it's something like the year 2030, which sounds pretty soon to me. I don't think I'll be alive. But anyway, kids and grandkids will be alive in 2030. The thing that was really startling to me, I thought, well, you could play with those numbers a little bit different way, and you can get the date to change. He said that if something were to happen to double the amount of oil in the ground right now, double it, at our present rates of increase in consumption, increase in population, that would only add another 15 years. We're going to run out of oil. I mean, there's no question about it. What are we willing to trade for it? What are we willing to risk for that? The environment, the lives of soldiers.
Thanks.
Well, Lovins also said that if we were using oil efficiently, we could get by on 1/5 of what we're using and get the same results from our oil. I think this is a great opportunity. I think we ought to welcome this. I think anything that will raise the price of oil is good. It won't raise it enough. That's the unfortunate thing about it. It ought to raise it a couple of dollars a gallon. There's just absolutely no reason in the world why we should go to war for 7% of our imports. That's 3.5% of our oil usage. That's what we import from Iraq and Kuwait. Of course, if you throw in Saudi Arabia, we import about 14% of our imports from Saudi Arabia. So you got 21% of your imports. So you got 10% of the oil we use coming those three countries. Well, throw in Qatar too, and you've got a few more percentages of our imports, but certainly not more than 25% of our imports, or 12.5% of our oil usage. If we increase the miles per gallon of our cars by 20 miles a gallon, say, we'd save a billion barrels of oil a year. That is 33% of our imports. I mean, there's so many things we can do and so many things we could use this occasion for, except going to war. But I suspect that because we are operating under a thesis that we need to get whatever product we can at the cheapest price we can, we will do everything in our power to prevent Iraq from taking the Kuwait oil and taking the Arabian oil. I think the Arabian oil is much more. There are 255 billion gallons in reserve in Arabia, is over against about 200 in Iraq and Kuwait. So it's Arabia that really, if you put that all together, you got 455, you put Qatar, that's about 100 more, that's 555 billion gallons in a world resource that certainly doesn't go much beyond 700 billion gallons. So you've got a good percentage of the world oil right in that little corner of the world.
Minor correction, billion barrels.
Billion barrels. Gallon. That's right. Billion barrels. Right. Billion barrels. So that the real problem is our dependency on oil, and that's. I just think it's an opportunity that we won't take it. I don't know what you can do about it, but it's an opportunity for us to get rid of our dependency upon a foreign market. And incidentally, we ought to do that about a lot of other things, so that we don't go to war in order to protect the cheap source of resources from other countries. That's about all I have to say.
Oh, thanks. Dick?
I've been asked to comment about what would be a nonviolent alternative in this situation. And I think what we've heard so far certainly is part of the nonviolent alternative is to reduce our dependence, our addiction to oil, and to work on alternatives. And those are, as you say, in a way, it may be a gift to us to be confronted with this crisis, because it maybe will force us to look at the alternatives that we have to be engaged in. But there's some other aspects to a nonviolent alternative also. Sometimes I think you feel all you can do from a nonviolent point of view is protest. To say that the quick draw McGraw approach to foreign relations is not the best role for the United States. That we're not meant to be the world policeman. We don't have to intervene in every situation in the world and try to set it right. But at least we ought to give a chance for some other countries to try to resolve the situation in their own backyard before we move in. But I think although sometimes we feel that we're in a position where protest is the only thing we can do, we're in a better position, a stronger position, if we can also pose a realistic, nonviolent alternative, an alternative to sending, you know, hundreds of F-15s and F-16s and 200,000 troops into an area, and aircraft carriers and all the other stuff that's happening. But some people feel like, well, nonviolence is this sort of theory, you know, on earth as it is in heaven, that nonviolence is here in heaven, and that you can just kind of bring it down and apply it on earth in any kind of situation. And I don't think that's true. I think we're, as people who believe in or are interested in nonviolent approaches, a little bit more like the military, And I imagine that when George Bush was confronted with this Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, he didn't just get his military guys together in a room and say, okay, let's go, you know, military response, get in there, you know. They sat down around a table in the cabinet room and said, well now, what's the geographical situation in Iraq? What forces do we have that would be applicable there that might have a chance of being effective, and what ones wouldn't be effective? What are the strengths and weaknesses of Iraq? How can we undercut their strengths and confront their weaknesses in a way that would give us a chance of winning in a military kind of way? So they do a lot of assessment, and George probably said, well, we need a lot of answers. We need more satellite information. We need people on the ground, you know, getting this information to us and so on. We're going to get back together tomorrow, and hopefully we'll have a little bit more information on which to begin to build a policy. And it probably took a week or so before they could say, okay, well, here's exactly what we're going to do. And I think in the nonviolent movement, we have to do that same kind of assessment. We have to have our people who know or can quickly get as much of a grasp as possible of the situation in the Arab world. And then we can think about, like, what are some of the nonviolent traditions in the Arab world that might be applied to a situation like this? What are some of the examples of nonviolent intervention from outside of a country into a country which might be applicable and which would be a realistic alternative to a military kind of situation? One of the big issues here, beyond oil conservation and things like that, is Iraq has invaded Kuwait and has set up a puppet government. I mean, this is a terrible thing. This is an extreme injustice. This is something that everybody ought to be very upset about and ought to be protesting, you know. And I don't blame people from being outraged at that. But what do you do militarily to confront a situation like that, of one country taking over another and imposing a puppet government on it? They talk about, well, if we tried to confront that militarily, we're going to have a terrible situation because Iraq probably is going to use their chemical warfare. And then when they talk about that, they say, well, if they use their chemical warfare, that would require a very serious response, or a very severe response, as I think what Baker said, to that. Well, when they say severe, what are they talking about? They're talking about B-52s flying in from Guam or from Diego Garcia and dropping 500-pound bombs all throughout, you know, the capital of Iraq, killing thousands, tens of thousands of civilians, destroying the economy. I mean, you can imagine the kind of destruction and slaughter that will occur if there is a war over this. So a military response doesn't seem very adequate to that. Is there another alternative, another way to look at it? I think if we were sitting in that cabinet room, you know, we would be trying to kick around some nonviolent possibilities. And I've just begun to think about this. So as you brainstorm, you just throw out some ideas, and they may be wild, they may be off the wall, they may not be right initial. But here's just some things to throw out for your consideration. One is the economic boycott. That's the embargo of Iraq. That's a good nonviolent technique. I support that 100%. I think one of the things to do would be to strengthen that, to monitor it better. Iraq is only supposed to have about 90 days that it can function on its own with its own resources. So a boycott is a good nonviolent method. But what would be beyond that? One way might be to say, here, just kind of brainstorming and throw this out. Look, the Arabs are a great people. They have a long and illustrious civilization. It's against the Quran for Arabs to kill Arabs. They want to resolve this situation. Let's give them some time to work on this and to try to work it out themselves and to give them every support, rather than our feeling we have to dash in there and solve it immediately. What might we be proposing to them from a nonviolent point of view? Well, there is some Arab experience of nonviolent intervention in the Algerian revolution, for example. There was some marvelous nonviolent intervention that was done. Without getting into that, because we don't have time, here would just be kind of a radical proposal to throw out. A pan-Arabic nonviolent expeditionary force that would be a joint effort of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, anybody that could get together on this, who would march unarmed into Kuwait to appeal to the Iraqi soldiers to leave Kuwait. at the same time calling upon the Kuwaitis not to accept the puppet government, but to do everything in terms of strikes, boycotts, parallel government, everything they could to nonviolently protest and not go along with this puppet regime that's being imposed upon them, and use those two things, an internal nonviolent non-cooperation and an external nonviolent expeditionary force to try to get Iraq out of Kuwait.
Thanks. Well, we want to open it up now to all of you. I will say again that we realize this issue in the Middle East is really complex and that we're just sort of taking stabs at it here from different directions. Thursday there will be a panel that will look more specifically at Christian-Jewish relations. It will involve Phyllis Taylor, Dick's wife, who is Jewish, and Peter Cheseth, who's a New Testament scholar working on the Gospel of John. We want to talk about some of the Middle East dynamics involving Israel as well, and our role as Christians in that whole Middle East situation. So I just wanted to say that in advance. But get into some of that foreign policy stuff tonight, or focus more on environmental kinds of things. Or we've just tried to present a diversity of viewpoints here, and I realize we don't have all the bases covered as far as this whole issue, and want to hear from all of you. Now, your opinions, perspectives, don't feel, it does not need to be, in fact, I'd rather not have it be like a question and answer thing where you pose questions to the panelists, but rather hear from you about your own perspectives. Uh-huh.
There's an interesting irony that goes with what you mentioned, Alan, and what you mentioned, Dick. In
contrasting, can you speak a little louder?
Yeah, in contrasting Iraq's role and philosophy in Kuwait's, there's a fascinating irony. You think of Kuwait as the invaded good guys, and Iraq is the invading bad guys. I know it wasn't your intention to highlight that, but I want to reinforce something you said, because Kuwait was in fact violating all the OPEC rules, and their philosophy is deliberately to drive the price of oil down to further addict the Western nations to their oil. And in recent months, they have been the only big oil producer to invest heavily in total control of the downstream process. They've got refineries, they've got distribution, they have over 480 very modern service stations all over Western Europe, which have their new logo, Q8, on the sign. And so their whole thing was to sell lots and lots of cheap oil and get Western Europe in particular, emerging Europe, of course, along with Eastern Europe, that much more addicted to Kuwaiti oil. And so, by contrast, here comes Iraq wanting to ram the price up so they can pay off their debts quicker, and Iraq may be doing us the favor in the long run, was my observation.
Others?
I just want to play devil's advocate for a minute, but all those statistics about running out of oil and all that stuff was all just hammered and pounded and hammered and pounded for about 5 years, from starting in about 1968. Until 73, when we were in gas lines, and then it went on a while longer, and then we all went to sleep for 20 years. And I just, you know, I'm saying, what happened? I was doing this 20 years ago, and I don't know what happened. And I really like what, is it Taylor?
Mm-hmm.
Here, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the idea that there's maybe this time something concrete that we can do.
Would one comment on the use of ethanol? I've heard that a lot of the cars in Brazil use ethanol entirely in their cars, and that's something we could produce ourselves in the United States.
All the corn in the United States used for oil, I understand, would give us 20% of our gasoline needs. All the corn that's produced in the United States.
Do you want to say something about hydrogen? I know that's what you believe is the car of the future. Yeah.
Well, I just know that Peugeot and Renault, the French government, just put $200 million into a 7-year research project on hydrogen cars. And I think there's some dangers with hydrogen, but certainly, if you're thinking about the pollution of the, carbon emissions, you would be willing to sacrifice a little bit of danger for the whole universe, the whole Earth being threatened with global warming. That's, of course, the added factor that we didn't have last time, and I don't know that it's going to be any more effective than the situation in the 70s. But there's one more factor now. We should cut back on our fossil fuel use 80% within 10 years.
Others? Uh-huh.
Yes, I'm concerned that there be something we can do now, because as we see this true buildup, and as we, at least as many of us, are afraid of what might happen, it's kind of how do we become empowered? And I think part of it is the personal, what do we do in terms of consumption? Part of it is very clearly the political right now. I mean, when you get out of, or when we leave Holden, for those, you've got a post office, where we can send letters. How do we get in touch right now, today, tomorrow, with our congresspeople, with the administration to say, do not commit the troops to fighting, strengthen the embargo. What can we be doing in terms of support? How can we make linkages with some of the particularly nonviolent folks in some of the countries in the Persian Gulf? How can we be supporting them? What do we want to do as U.S. citizens? How do we want to support others? And into this whole mess, I think, comes what we'll also touch on Thursday. What do we do with Israel, who is tremendously frightened by what is going on, as are people, Jewish folks, in this country, in terms of what could happen there in the whole Israeli, U.S., Arabic, Palestinian, Jewish, Christian mess. And so it's kind of how do we reach out, I think, to our congresspeople? How do we reach out to Israelis and Jews? How do we reach out to Palestinians? And how can we do it right now? Because I really do think it's the personal lifestyle change, but it is also very clearly right now the political getting the message across to the politicians in our country to tell them what we want of them and to hold them accountable. And then if they violate that, to be on the streets as well. So it's letter writing and it's walking and it's talking. All together, in a sense of absolute, a sense of absolute urgency.
How about others? You had a hand here and then one over here. You don't have to agree with anybody either. I mean, if you think it's good for U.S. troops to be there, that's fine too. At Holden, we don't take any official stance, so feel free to disagree too. Do you want to say something back there?
I was just curious about a statement the geologist made initially that we you know where all the oil is now. I was just curious, is that because of satellites or whatever? I mean, it hasn't gotten to the point where they've tracked every square mile of the Earth. How can we say for so sure that we know where it all is right now?
Well, on a large scale, we know pretty well what the overall geologic map of the Earth looks like. We know where there is the type of sedimentary basins in which oil could occur. We know where there are certain structures that oil could be trapped in. I worked for Mobil one summer. I was impressed with how much those people knew and didn't act on. I mean, they had people leasing land, researching these countries and those countries just for having that knowledge in store in case something happened where they needed to go for it. I'm not involved in any kind of oil-related research or work directly, so I'm not positive. But from what I've seen and from what I've heard, I believe that statement that we pretty much know where everything is. It's not a matter of drilling to find it. I mean, there's the corroboration between looking at rocks on the surface and structures on the surface and finding oil in the ground or not finding it on the ground, that's so good that you can predict just by looking on the surface where you're going to find it.
There's a hand back here.
I'm not sure what our total gas usage is, but the answer to ethanol, it's a good one, but it stretches our imagination trying to make it all the way. We produce about 8 billion bushels of corn a year, and that would make about 20 billion gallons of gas of ethanol. So it's a long ways from meeting our total needs. The other comment I'd like to, or a frustration, is that a nonviolent approach to the Middle Eastern situation becomes so frustrating because so much of the religion there seems to be, and if it's a bias, then correct me, that to die is to be a hero there. To take a nonviolent, or to take a peace force, would probably doom that group to being mowed down by violence. And I'm frustrated by coming up with answers where violence is just a way of life there. And trying to come up with something that would impress them would be very difficult.
Do you want to respond to?
Yeah, I'm no expert on Islam or anything like that, but I understand in the Quran it is of great value to die in a holy war against the infidel, but it's absolutely prohibited for one Muslim to kill another. And that's one of the things that distresses Arabs most about this, that the brother is killing brother, as they would put it. So that's one of the kind of values that can be played upon. I mean, here would be a way to try to bring about resolution of a situation without violating some of your most basic values.
For 8 years, they shot each other between Iraq and Iran.
Yeah, but look at the reaction of other Arab countries to that. I mean, they're very disposed to that.
They just stood there and fired at each other.
Okay, you had a hand. Go ahead.
Well, I find it curious that in light of our government saying we were going to reduce the defense spending and we might close numerous bases throughout the United States, and as the states have been proposed that they would close those bases, those senators and representatives were inundated with, you can't do that to our areas because it will take away jobs. And suddenly, what a wonderful opportunity that we can send hundreds of thousands of forces in, and therefore we are certainly not going to close bases in that. So is this really an issue that we need to be involved in, or is it merely a way to keep our bases open and not to reduce defense spending?
They're already talking about the fact the budget, you know, can't cut the budget. We spent $28 billion accompanying those oil tankers in and out of the Gulf there in that last crisis. $28 billion. You know, we use 6 billion barrels a year. That $28 billion, 6 and 28, what is it, $4 a barrel that we spent to just accompany the ships.
Robert, you've got a hand. Then you guys can jump into it.
I just like to suggest the possibility that this is perhaps the first instance that we're seeing of the United States government using its power to go to war to protect our lifestyle and our standard of living, and that by doing so we may have seized an opportunity of the events in the Middle East to gain control perhaps of all of Kuwaiti oil and maybe even Iraqi oil for ourselves. In the same way as that in years to come we may go to war to gain control of grain or agriculture in other countries.
Sobering, huh?
Uh-huh. One thing that I wonder, we talk about there's war, and because we've sent some defensive troops to Saudi Arabia, that somehow war has been declared. I think you're misleading a lot of people when you make it sound like because we sent 100,000 defensive troops to Saudi Arabia, that somehow war is imminent, and I don't think that's correct. We have American troops in about 60, 70 different countries of the world, and we don't have war in all of those countries that U.S. troops are stationed in. And we're not the only country going to Saudi Arabia's defense. England is sending planes and ships. France is sending ships. A lot of other countries are sending ships. And because we're sending 100,000 troops, doesn't mean we're going to war tomorrow or next month or next year. It was every country in the United Nations Security Council voted against them in their deployment of troops into a small country, a very small country. This country has the largest military machine in that part of the world. Their military machine is larger than the United States' military machine. They have more men in their military than the United States Army and all of our other troops have together. So it's not like we're going in there to declare war on anybody. We're going there to make a point, and a lot of other countries are going in there to make a point, that oil is important until we can figure out a way to come up with another source of energy. Oil is all we have. That's how we got to Holden. That's how we're going to get back home again, is oil. Cars are 20 to 30% more efficient now than they were back during the last energy crisis. There was a statement made that no new oil has been found. I've been reading this weekend Megatrends 2000, and one of the items in there was in 1979, proven world oil reserves were 611 billion barrels. Today, and they were falling fast, today there are 887 billion barrels of oil, and it's growing fast. They discovered oil in about six new areas that 5 years ago they didn't even know about. So I would say until we have another source of cheap fuel to get us to Holden or wherever we're going, we have to rely on that, and it is important that we make a statement. This is a country that killed its own people with gas, you know, and the guy's been called the Hitler of the Middle East, and we all stand back and say, well, you know, let them kill each other off. And I think, you know, the United States has a responsibility to go along with the rest of the countries that are sending troops in to make a statement. We're not going to war. We're going there to keep another country from going into Saudi Arabia, which is important to our country, and a friend of our country for many, many years.
Uh-huh. Do you
want to
respond?
I have to disagree. I hope we have a historian here, and I would like to know what the history of Kuwait is. I do know that in 61, it was turned over from the British to the royal family now. And I think it's a study of Western involvement in that region prior to the so-called turning back over of that piece of land to a people indigenous to the area would be enlightening for us. And I'd also like to ask you, if it was in fact an act of violence, well, certainly it was, when Iraq invaded Kuwait. It seems to be an economic question, and people have realized in the past few weeks that Saddam Hussein was very shrewd. You know, I think he listens to his economists. He's gonna gain by moving into Kuwait, and it was a good risk. I'm not supporting that, but economically it was a good risk. And part of global economics is having a military to back up the transfer and the flow of goods. You can't export goods to other nations if you can't protect those goods from so-called pirates. That would be the capitalist justification for police and armies. Our army is not over there to make a statement. That's bad, Iraq. Anyone could say that. It's been said. And I, you know, I guess
so
I'm trying to address.
So you feel they're there to go to war, or
no, protect the economic system.
The military supports economics.
Yeah.
You know, you can't have however many hundred billion barrels of oil sitting around without an army.
But you got 170 million Iraqi soldiers in Kuwait for what? Right on the border of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia.
I don't think it's 170 million, Alan.
170,000. Okay.
We're shoulder to shoulder.
But my question is, I mean, if we look at contemporary history, if we go back 1 year or 29 years to 1961, yes, Iraq has no right to be in Kuwait. But do they?
Well, Arabia is the problem. Kuwait is not the problem. Arabia and Israel are the problem. if Iraq takes Kuwait and is allowed to move without any response, then Arabia is the next strong arm situation, and then you know that Israel is the next.
But you're making the point that Kuwait has claims, or I mean that Iraq claims that they have a claim in Kuwait. Yeah,
they do.
Yeah. A legitimate claim, and that's part of greater Iraq.
I don't know.
Iraq.
They might have a historical claim to that area.
But in the newspapers it says that they are claiming that this was given to this family by the Western powers in the settlement. And so it's really that oil belongs to the people of the area, not this one family.
But are they claiming Arabia's does as well? Or is this just a dominant
That's
theory?
Just their claim.
Can I just direct it a little bit? You're right, we need a historian here badly. I have a feeling, though, that we're going to get further sort of enmeshed in politics and history that most of us don't know a lot about, and of course then I won't feel like I know what's going on, and then we'll lose control here. So I want to invite...
In the lifetime of our children and grandchildren, we will run out of oil. Well, don't our leaders know that?
They won't be in office that long.
We are a very bright nation, and we spend all kinds of money on research. And you were very impressed with oil company, were you with?
Mobil.
Mobil knows more than a lot of universities, I suppose. Now, he seems to have a different statistical approach, but isn't there some, I hear this again and again and again, about the finite supply. Certainly, if there is a finite supply, we know it. Why aren't we doing something more radical about it? I mean, this is just a dust-up now in the Arab thing, if indeed the basic problem is that in 40 years, 50 years, we're out of oil. The whole globe.
I can't answer that question. I mean, that is the question. You know, it's statistics like this, and I maybe spoke a little bit too strongly about exactly when. As I preface those remarks, you know, the statistics can change, or you can report differently. Just from my understanding of the way the Earth works, there is a finite amount, and the rate that we're using up oil is faster than it's being produced, and if it runs out in the year 2030 or the year 2045 or even the year 2080 or the year 2100 or whatever, you know, it's happening within the time span of descendants that I think that are very close to us, whether they're grandchildren or great grandchildren. So, but the question, you know, why aren't we doing something about it? Why isn't, with all the research that's been done, advances in solar power and wind energy and these things, why aren't they being employed? I mean, that's a really good question. Maybe Al, who's thought about this more, can answer that. And what I think is that that's not where the big bucks is. You can't make money on the sun. The sun's free. And it's still the economy that's the oil-based economy that's running everything.
I was going to say, hopefully I'm online here, but we have a tremendous amount of economic investment in our use of oil, and unfortunately the way I see it is that the United States and many other developed nations in the world are in a technological fixed situation where they don't deal with situations until they become a crisis situation. At that point they feel like they can overcome the problems that are at hand. What's happening now is that Iraq has thrown a monkey wrench into our assessment of the future as far as when we think we may run out of oil reserves. I think everyone knows in the political framework that eventually we will run out of it. They're hoping and banking on, by the time that happens, that technologically we will be able to bandage the problem. And as far as oil reserves go, much of what I have been taught recently is that oil reserves are being sought out in other forms such as shale. Mm. And if we want to go to those measures to extract shale or oil from shale rock, then we'll be mowing down the Rocky Mountains and many other beautiful and environmentally delicate environments in North America as well as all over the world. So potentially we could have oil for a very long time, but it's like he said, how far do we want to go? Do we want to mow down the Rocky Mountains, or do we want to abuse pristine ecology? I don't know if that helps at all, but one thing that's really bummed me out is this attitude is that, well, we don't really have to worry about it until we get to the point of we have to worry about it, and we have no other choice than to put a Band-Aid over a gaping gash.
Thanks. Okay, Laura? We only have a few more minutes, so if you got comments you're going to want to say about this oil stuff, not even, okay.
Just to mention that, I don't think the issue is when we're going to run out. I think the issue is what we're doing to ourselves by burning it now. And I was reading somewhere the other day where they said that if we stopped burning hydrocarbons in 3 or 4 days, we'd be able to see 60 to 90 miles in our cities again and be able to breathe the air. And, I mean, I think the point is that this stuff is killing us. And it's not just killing us if we get into a war, it's killing us now because we're breathing the effects of doing it. And that, to me, seems to be the more crucial issue.
I'd like to tie together maybe three things that were said. And I think that the reliance on oil and what's happening there is a reflection on wanting to maintain a lifestyle that is killing us now, and that is incredibly greedy, and it is not looking at the environment or much of the developing world. So I agree with that fundamental basis. I also agree with you, sir, that there needs to be a response. That I think when injustice happens, when invasions like this happen, I think we absolutely need to respond in creative ways. My question is it the troops? And I would come out saying this was not, to send the troops is not what I would have hoped. To support the embargo would be what I hoped. But I think clearly we have to take an absolutely firm line to say this is unacceptable. And how do we support ways to make that very clear that it's unacceptable? I also agree with you that at the most fundamental basis is in that region, the hatred of Israel and the desire to get rid of Israel, that is a fairly universal desire by many of the people in that region. And that spills back over, I think, to particularly the responsibility or the question of the response of Christians, looking at the history when there was not very good response of Christians to, again, the attempt to annihilate a people. So I think all of those things weave together in a way that, again, for me, gives a tremendous urgency on all levels.
I'd like to respond to one thing on that.
Okay.
If, first of all, we did nothing until the United Nations had passed the resolutions. We didn't even talk about sending troops. Number two, if the Iraqis had gone into Saudi Arabia, I guarantee you Israel would have responded. Yeah. If nothing else, we've delayed Israel responding. Israel has already gone in and knocked out their nuclear power plant that they said was strictly for energy, and then later on they found out it really was to build an atomic bomb. So if nothing else, perhaps our sending 100,000 defensive troops into Saudi Arabia is going to keep that thing from exploding into another world war. I think you're all jumping to the conclusion we're going to have a world war over this, or at least one heck of a big fight down there. And I think we would have had one heck of a big fight down there if they had gone 2 feet over, they were within 3 feet of the border. If they had gone over that border, I guarantee you Israel would have gone in there and done something about it. And then you probably really would have had one heck of a war.
Okay, there's one hand. We haven't heard from you yet. I think the rest of you will just have to say we'll have to continue the conversation because I also want to give the panelists a chance to say some wrap-up. Uh-huh, go ahead.
Okay, what I was thinking about, if all the dinosaurs had gotten together and come and had a little larger brains and discussed how they could have survived, that maybe we wouldn't exist and it would only be dinosaurs around. And after we've been kind of talking about the billions and billions of years, you know, that our whole creation has existed, and then all of a sudden we're kind of worried about these few thousands of years that we've been around, that maybe we really shouldn't be too concerned whether it comes or goes. Because when you think of what the beautiful creation, and after we've been talking today on geology and how things ebb and flow, and the earth was starting maybe as a solid mass, and yet we get mountains that aren't always going to stay as mountains, but are going to dip and become part of this molten mass again, and then recreate. I know all of a sudden we're kind of concerned about ourselves, but when you look at God's creation and the whole thing, then you kind of wonder, boy, you know, where are we coming from? Even though we're trying to protect ourselves, and yet there's such a greater thing that's behind all this.
Well, that introduces a new element here. I think thank you. On that note here, we better wrap up. Thanks to all of you for coming. Are there